You may have seen a somewhat peculiar title advertised for this talk. What happened was somebody said, "Will you talk at the convention?" And I said, "Yes, I love the sound of my own voice." And they said, "What are you going to talk about?" And I said, "Well, a good title would be A Different Kick, or How to Get High Without Actually Going into Orbit." So they put that down. The title has nothing whatsoever to do with what I'm going to talk about. I hope nobody is disappointed. I'm going to begin by reading a fairly long extract from a book which gives me what I think of as a science fiction feeling. It generates the same kind of stirring of the emotions which I look for in a good science fiction story. Going from surprise to surprise, Estevan discovered a plurality of beaches where the sea, 3 centuries after the discovery, was beginning to deposit its first pieces of polished glass. Glass invented in Europe and strange to America. Glass from bottles, from flasks, from demijohns, in shapes hitherto unknown on the new continent. Green glass with opacities and bubbles. Delicate glass destined for embryonic cathedrals whose hagiography had been effaced by the water. Glass fallen from ships or saved from shipwrecks, polished by the waves with the skill of a turner or a goldsmith till the light was restored to its extenuated colours and cast up as a mysterious novelty on this ocean shore. There were black beaches formed of slate and pulverized marble where the sunlight formed sparkling furrows. Yellow beaches with shifting slopes where each flux left behind the trace of its arabesque, constantly smoothing it away before returning to inscribe another. White beaches, so white, so dazzlingly white, that on them sand would have shown as an imperfection, for they were vast cemeteries of broken shells, tossed, tumbled, triturated shells, reduced to a powder so fine it escaped through one's fingers like water. No symbol can form better to the idea of the sea than that of the amphibious women of the ancient myths, whose flesh had been present to men's hands in the pink cavity of the stroms, to which for centuries the mariners of the archipelago had pressed their mouths to produce from them the raucous sound of a trombone, of a Neptunian bull, of some solar creature bellowing out across an immensity dedicated to the sun. Carried into a world of symbiosis, standing up to his neck in pools whose water was kept perpetually foaming by cascading waves and was broken, torn, shattered by the hungry bite of jagged rocks, Estevan marveled to realize how the language of these islands had made use of agglutination, verbal amalgams and metaphors to convey the formal ambiguity of things which participated in several essences at once. Just as certain trees were called acacia bracelets, pineapple porcelain, wood rib, 10 o'clock broom, cousin clover, pitcher pine kernel, design cloud and iguana stick, many marine creatures had received names which established verbal equivocations in order to describe them accurately. Thus a fantastic bestiary had arisen of dogfish, oxenfish, tigerfish, snorers, blowers, flying fish, of striped, tattooed and tawny fish, fish with their mouths on top of their heads or their gills in the middle of their stomachs, white bellies, swordfish and mackerel, a fish which bit off testicles, cases had been known, another that was herbivorous, the red speckled sand eel, a fish which became poisonous after eating manchineel apples, not forgetting the vieja fish, the captain fish with his gleaming throat of golden scales, or the woman fish, the mysterious and elusive manatees glimpsed in the mouths of rivers where the salt water mingled with the fresh, with their feminine profiles and their siren's breasts playing joyful nuptial pranks on one another in their watery meadows. Sometimes a great silence foreshadowing an event would fall over the water, and then some enormous, belated, obsolete fish would appear, a fish from another epoch, its face placed at the extreme end of its massive body, living in a perpetual fear of its own slowness, its hide covered with vegetation and parasites like an uncareened hull. The huge back emerged amidst a swirl of remoras, with the solemnity of a raised galleon, as this patriarch of the depths, this leviathan ejecting sea foam, emerged into the light of day for what might perhaps be only the second time since the astrolabe was brought into these seas. The monster opened its pachyderm's eyes, and discovering a battered sardine boat sailing nearby, submerged once more, anxious and afraid, down towards the solitude of the depths, to await some other century before it returned again to a world full of perils. The event concluded, the sea went back to its business. Now, I deliberately didn't mention the author of that. Probably it struck you, it certainly strikes me, as bearing a strong resemblance to passages and stories I've read by Jimmy Ballard. I think perhaps you'll have seen what I mean when I say it generates a science fiction feeling. But it is, in fact, from a historical novel. It's from Alejo Carpentier's Explosion in a Cathedral. And I'd like you to contrast it with this one. This we do not hastily. This we do not in passion. This we do without hatred. This is not the battle when a man strikes fiercely and fear drives him on. This is not the hot quarrel when two strive for place or the love of a woman. Not the rope, quench the axe, pour the poison, pile the faggots. This is the one who killed his fellow unprovoked. This is the one who stole the child away. This is the one who spat upon the image of our God. This is the one who leagued himself with the devil to be a witch. This is the one who corrupted our youth. This is the one who told the enemy of our secret places. We are afraid, but we do not talk of fear. We have many deep thoughts and doubts, but we do not speak them. We say justice. We say the law. We say we, the people. We say the state. I said contrast that, and it is a contrast, isn't it? I think that forms a perfect capsule history of human social development. And it's so good that, in fact, I recall one time I had it by heart, and C.S. Lewis came to the Globe, and I recited it to him. Before I'd finished, he was fishing for paper and pencil and saying, "That's marvelous, that's wonderful, who wrote it? I must read it." And it comes, as I'm sure you'll have realized, from one of the undisputed masterworks of modern SF, George Stewart's Earth Abides. Now, the reason that I opened this talk with those two passages is quite simple. It is that my subject is not simple at all. It's notorious that a liking for SF goes with a pattern of other interests which may not be very obviously related. Some of them wander pretty far afield, like Walter Willis's sauce bottle fandom, for example. But I don't want to pursue this particular point much further than to voice the truism that there are very, very few people who read only science fiction and the daily papers. So when I was asked to pick some subject to talk about at the convention, it struck me that it might be illuminating to examine some of the preferences that people who read SF exhibit in other areas of fiction. It seemed to me that this might perhaps open up a line of attack on a very vexed question indeed, which people are in fact talking about a great deal at this convention, the relationship between mainstream fiction and science fiction. Charging rather brashly ahead on this somewhat facile assumption, I ran slap up against the difficulty which those two passages I've just read exemplify. The Stewart is of an almost classical simplicity. If you can put up with a few statistics, there are in that passage exactly 163 words. There are 4 trisyllables, hastily, unprovoked, corrupted, and enemy. There are 19 disyllables, and every last one of the others is a monosyllable, and the result is it goes like a machine gun. It's deliberately pure, it's almost primitive, it's very reminiscent of passages in the authorized version of the Bible, the King James Bible to our overseas visitors. And what's more, Stewart has packed it with formerly archaic images like pile the faggots and leagued himself with the devil to be a witch. But this is from a science fiction novel. On the other hand, the Carpentier is a positive treasure chest of the exotic. There's a resounding quality of alienness, I think, in the description of the beaches that Estevan walks over, and the life forms that he witnesses around him. And there's a feeling of being dominated by enormous natural processes and a sense of huge, strange distances where man is only very slowly making a mark. Witness the glass turning up 3 centuries after the discovery of the New World, which is still strange in the Americas and has been made more so by being worked over and over by the sea into new, wonderful forms. And all this culminating in the vision of this enormous, belated, obsolete fish, where I think the choice of the word belated is an absolute masterstroke on the part of the translator. All this could so easily be transferred to an alien planet circling another sun, and yet Explosion in the Cathedral is a historical novel. So when I found myself faced with contradictions of this order of magnitude, I had to abandon my original, rather superficial assumptions, and I had to sit down and do some very hard thinking. And the conclusions that was driven to are perhaps not going to please everybody, but I think they will start some arguments, and I look forward to provoking at least a little discussion on the basis of what I'm saying. The conclusion, in fact, that I reached was that if we fence off SF as something uniquely admirable, we are doing both it and ourselves a very great disservice. And I'm going to try and spell out the steps by which I arrived at this conclusion. Well, we'd better begin by establishing some kind of a criterion for the peculiar appeal that science fiction exercises. I'm not going to try and define science fiction. One can spend all night doing that, and many people frequently do. I'm not even going to try and lay down standards to define what is and what is not good SF. I think one can take it for granted that if you give the same book which you like to 10 people, something like the following pattern will emerge. You'll get 5 who say, "This is pretty good. I thoroughly enjoyed it." And you'll get 2 who say, "Yes, it's not bad, but I wish the author had or hadn't done something," which he didn't. And you'll get 2 people who say, "I didn't really think very much of it." And you get 1 person who says it's a load of old codswallop and Vargas Stratton is a much better writer anyway. Well, we'll leave this gentleman to his good fortune. Well, he is fortunate, isn't he? Sturgeon's Law puts it, 90% of science fiction is rubbish because 90% of everything is rubbish, and he has so much more to enjoy. Yeah. Oh, yes, I was talking about good science fiction and the effective impossibility of defining its qualities. This, of course, holds good for any creation in fiction. What we can perhaps do is identify some of the qualities which draw readers to it and keep them reading it. I think of greatness in art, in any form of creative work, in terms of what you might call insights. I'm sure you know what they call by that rather clumsy term, the authentic frisson. This is the shiver of pure awe that runs down your spine when you feel that you're in the presence of something that is great. It's a little akin to Huysman's test for true poetry. He said it was true poetry if it made the bristles on his chin stand up when he recited it while he was shaving. What this moment of the authentic frisson is, I think, is a sense of being made, however briefly, more wise. Wisdom, like love and charity and a heck of a lot of other words, has been very badly debased. But in the archetypal sense, whether it's from poetry or music or painting or sculpture or from what, I think that this is what is happening to you when the cold shiver goes up and down the spine. It's a sense of being better able to appreciate and comprehend and enjoy the experience which the world around offers, whether it's personal, whether it's to do with people, or whether it's to do with objects. And this, in the original sense of the word wisdom, is wisdom. It's cognate with the German word wissen, to know. It's cognate also with wittern, as in Witternagemotum, meeting of wise men. And oh, for all I know, it connects with the Zen concept of Satori and being sort of totally connected to the universe. But I won't pursue this point any further because it's a great deal too much to hope for that we should get this from everything we read. And quite frankly, I think for most people it would be absolutely unbearable. But it does seem, I think, reasonable to suppose that one's preferred reading, the reason why a given person prefers one particular kind of reading over any other, is that out of all the available choices, this one gives him a particular intangible bonus, a faint shadow of this sense of being made wise, which one feels in the presence of something really great. So some people will read detective stories, some people will read westerns, historical novels, and some people will read science fiction. Typically, they'll buy, they'll read, they'll talk about, and they will enjoy science fiction, and they'll get less of a bang out of other kinds of fiction. But the important word here is typically, and this brings me, I think, to the kernel of my argument. People don't read, as I said before, just SF and the daily papers. We have at best a statistical distribution which is skewed in certain cases along a science fiction axis. It's barely sharp enough for us to isolate elements of science fiction's appeal to its readers, but I propose to demonstrate that it is, I think, just barely possible. Now, I can't be exhaustive about this subject. For one thing, I don't want to use up the whole of my allotted time. I do tend to run off at the mouth, rather. And I'm going to have to confess confine myself, then, to throwing out some opinions which seem provocative, and perhaps during discussion we can reach some conclusions with some critical value. Well, I'm going to start by disregarding some of the most generally accepted elements of science fiction, such as its usefulness as a vehicle for social criticism and satire, simply because I don't think these are the most likely aspects of science fiction to attract and hold new readers. I don't think they're even likely to turn somebody into a fellow traveling enthusiast. What I am going to do is to take four prominent aspects of science fiction, subdivided into two groups, and I'm going to try and examine each of these in relation to other forms of entertainment fiction, and occasionally non-fiction read for pleasure. I'm going to try and be guided by three main lines. First, by what's a matter of record, the preferences that science fiction fans have acknowledged in conversation in letters and fanzines and so forth. Second, by what writers with a science fiction background prefer to tackle when they turn outside science fiction. And third, by what people in science fiction feel about the attempts of people not in science fiction to write science fiction plots. I hope that's not unduly involved. Well, the four attributes that I'm going to take begin with a pair which I would call perhaps expansive, outward-turned, outward-looking. One source of science fiction's appeal which springs immediately to mind is the sense that I mentioned in connection with that passage from Carpentier, the mood of comprehension of huge impersonal forces at work. Lovecraft once said that the true hero of a Marvel tale is never a person, but always an event. And coming a bit closer to home, John Wyndham has defined what he calls the masculinist approach of science fiction as against the feminist approach of much contemporary straight fiction. Science fiction being harder and less concerned with subjective insight and more with the objective impact of outside event. I suppose the ultimate example in science fiction would be a book like Last and First Men. Now that's really rather silly because there isn't a book like Last and First Men. It is, in fact, the outstanding example. But one of the reasons I chose Stuart and Carpentier to open the talk with is that you can go on citing both of them. Earth Abides is a remarkable achievement in exactly this area. There are some passages in Earth Abides showing the world getting on without man, which I think are virtually unparalleled. A visual parallel to this, in some sense, is to be found in that shot of the underground atomic station in Forbidden Planet. You recall there is a shot which fills the entire letterbox-shaped screen, and out from the bottom right-hand corner walk two men the size of ants. And this, for a moment, I think gives precisely this sense that I'm talking about of things huge beyond man working without his control. And it seems to me that this fits my underlying thesis of being enlightened by one's preferred reading very neatly indeed. It's a commonplace that really big numbers mean nothing. 1 million miles, 1 million years. But suddenly to begin to feel in the guts when it counts what a geological epoch comprehends, or what it would be like to be stranded between galaxies in boundless space. This is a real discovery on the emotional plane, and science fiction has enabled a great many people to make it. It's a sort of literary equivalent to seeing a high mountain for the first time after being raised in flat country, or on a somewhat more mundane scale, going up the Eiffel Tower or the Empire State for the first time. But is this sense of being in tune or aware of vast forces and vast changes unique to science fiction? I'm afraid I can only answer, good heavens, no. Consider some of George Stewart's other books which fit that dictum of Lovecraft's to a T, that the hero shall be an event rather than a person. Consider Fire, in which the hero is a forest fire, and Storm, in which the heroine, Mariah, is a storm from her birth as a trough of low pressure through her life of gales and sleet and snow to her final dissipation into the atmosphere. I think it's by no means a coincidence that having worked with plots like Fire and Storm, George Stewart was able to walk fully equipped into the science fiction field for the first time and carry off the International Fantasy Award. And let's cite another example comparable to this, which I know many fans will agree with. The novels of Marie Renaud, especially her two novels about Theseus, Bull from the Sea and The King Must Die. They exemplify in, I think, in two ways the point that I'm getting at. They engage the characters directly with vast forces, fate and destiny, which are beyond the scope of the individual to control, but can be adjusted to, can be in some sense directed. And secondly, she also conveys brilliantly the sense of an immense lapse of time between Theseus's day and ours by showing, I think with magnificent skill, the differing mental attitudes of people then and now. This has been achieved on a perhaps slightly less successful level by Mika Waltari in books like The Etruscan and the Egyptian, and it's also been achieved by of all people John Masters in Coromandel, where he performs the remarkable feat for a post-Freudian writer of creating a perfect pre-Freudian hero, a completely integrated natural man. But this is, by the way, I'll get back to Marie Renaud, because her novels lead me on very conveniently to the second of the two expansive attributes of science fiction that I'm trying to bring under consideration. And this is the allure of the exotic. I have to talk about this in quite some detail, because it's perhaps the most striking, and from a newcomer's point of view, the most obvious element of science fiction's appeal. To get where I want to wind up, I shall have to dig back quite a long way into the origins of contemporary science fiction. But first, in passing, I want to point out that this element of the exotic also fits my underlying thesis of being enlightened by one's preferred reading, in that it's just as much an enlargement of the imagination to have one's imagination stretched with concepts drawn from anthropology, from comparative religion, from all the things that science fiction draws on in order to create a sense of the exotic, as it is to be put in tune with vast forces and vast changes. Now, one curious and I think rather overlooked fact about the rise of modern science fiction is that it was more or less coincidental with the pushing back of the boundaries of the known world to the point where the last spaces marked here be tigers disappeared for good and all. It seems to me that the classical travellers' tales, like the Voyages of Marco Polo or the tales of Sir John Mandeville, are much more direct spiritual precursors of modern science fiction than the didactic utopias. Just as Burroughs gave an allegedly real setting to his stories of swashbuckling adventure by parking them on Mars and cashing in on the speculations of astronomers like Percival Lowell and Camille Flammarion, just so the retailers of marvellous legends used to, like Prester John's story, taking off this example, they used to set them in countries which were over the hill somewhere, and they'd stick names on them like Cathay or Norumbega or even California. And this is precisely the same thing that I do in a science fiction story if I call the background Tau Ceti 2 or 61 Cygni 3. Well, I could expatiate on this some length, but I'm going to content myself with pointing out another interesting cross-correlation with science fiction. In his book Names on the Land, which is a history of American place naming, and fascinating if you can get hold of it, George Stewart, who I said is very useful for citing, he goes into considerable detail on the stories that were circulating about mythical countries in America shortly after its discovery. Texas, for example, was formerly as mythical as El Dorado. And California was supposed to be an Amazonian island off the Pacific coast of North America. Amazonian in the sense that it had no men on it. It was ruled by a queen called Calaf, and every year she used to send out a raiding expedition, kidnap some men to be fathers of her subjects' children, and then they would put to death the men and any boy children that resulted. And Stewart points out an amusing sidelight on this. Consequently, anybody who'd been sailing around America and claimed to have discovered California was regarded either as touched in the head or an outright liar, because all well-educated people knew that California was mythological. It hasn't changed all that much, has it? thank you. It's interesting to note, anyway, that Stewart, who made such an astonishing success of his first entry into the science fiction field, also shares with science fiction readers this sense of the grandiose in myth and legend. Now, back to the lure of the exotic. I was just pointing out that as the boundaries of the known world receded, and they wiped out the last blanks on the map, so modern science fiction began to take on a recognisable form. I don't think this is... I don't think many people are going to disagree if I say that writers like Rider Haggard are in the direct spiritual line and ancestry of modern science fiction. Their heyday, and that of the romantic lost land adventure story, was in the same period when science fiction was beginning to assume its modern form, and Baron Wells and all those writers whose work has now become so classic that nobody reads it. Conador, for example, bridges the two forms neatly. The Lost World is an adventure story set in a somewhat dressed-up South America, and it borrows the appeal of a time travel story by putting extinct dinosaurs into the 20th century. Now, the mention of Rider Haggard cues me into a further stage of this argument. The argument, in fact, concerns the lure of the exotic in this sense of having one's horizons enlarged by inclusion of alien concepts. But Haggard is particularly useful because he handily underpins this point I was making earlier about the sense of comprehending vast changes and vast forces. He wrote some historical romances, and one or two of them are rather good. Red Eve is one, and The Virgin of the Sun is another. And these are both full to the brim with quasi-science fiction elements. One of the dominant motifs of Red Eve is sustained by the Black Death, and the displacement of the black by the plague-carrying brown rat is exploited to convey the same kind of mood that a science fiction writer might attempt to generate by importing an alien virus. In some ways, it makes very curious parallels worth the bite. And you could compare also the use that Wells made of the red weed in The War of the Worlds, which the producers of the film version left out because they didn't get the point. Any more than they got the point of Wells' masterly enhancement of the terror of his story by making the Martians come out smiling from the second use of every weapon that had been successful against them the first time. Similarly, in Haggard's Virgin of the Sun, one of the main elements of the opening section centers on a stranger in medieval London who's, for example, he's never seen soap. He wears a strange, unrecognizable idol on a chain around his neck. And he turns out to be from the land of the Incas, which is where the hero finally winds up after a very daring voyage. And this exactly parallels a device which is so common in science fiction that I don't think I need to cite any of the stories in which it's been used. It's not chance, incidentally, that in talking about the sense of vast changes and about the lure of the exotic, I refer again and again and again to historical novels. I'll preface my explanation of why this is not a coincidence, but accidental, with a couple of further points. It's worth noticing that more than one strand of the exotic has developed since the decline of the once popular Lost Lands tale. One strand is in science fiction, where people like Jack Vance conjure up the most beautiful, gaudy, brilliant exotic backgrounds for their stories. Another is found, oddly enough, in the contemporary novel. I think this is much influenced by cinema. And it's also found on television. I deduce the use of semi-abstract or surrealist backgrounds and environments for things like The Avenger, where the suspension of disbelief is just as necessary as it is in science fiction. And another strand of exotica, which is closest to the mainstream, is found, of course, in unashamed fantasy, where naturally it connects again directly with science fiction. Works set in never-never lands, like the Tolkien trilogy or Mövenpick's Titus Groan stories, they're halfway between science fiction and the historical story. There's a mood of primitivism implicit in them, even though nobody could ever mistake them for realistic historical stories. So against that simple background, let's consider the rather interesting phenomenon that science fiction writers who go outside their regular field and science fiction fans in general seem to display an interest in areas of history about which one doesn't learn very much in school. I say it very often, to take care of people like Fletcher Pratt, who was an authority on the American Civil War, and I think at the moment most of us have that coming out of our ears. And I'll also accept things like the widespread liking for C.S. Forrester's books that I've noticed among fans, because I'm going to come to that a little later on under a different heading. I'll just take a couple of shiny examples. Paul Anderson's written some fine sword-swinging historical adventures, and he's chosen for things like Rogue's Sword, the confused milieu of the 14th century Mediterranean, which in my education was lightly skimmed over, possibly out of patriotism, because England wasn't making much of a mark on the world scene at that time. And in fact, under the Angevin kings, it was regarded as a pretty second-rate piece of real estate, and whoever happened to own it at the time couldn't be bothered. And similarly, Sprague de Camp has written some fantastically enjoyable novels about undertakings like the building of the Colossus of Rhodes, which have the same qualities of internal consistency and attention to detail as his Krishna series, but this particular aspect of them also falls under a later heading. I think the closeness of the relationship between the offbeat historical novel like this, where one feels carried beyond the rather humdrum information that was beaten into one's head at school, and into an exciting, exotic, rather unpredictable kind of a world, The connection between this and science fiction will be further illustrated by considering the historical elements which science fiction writers import into their science fiction in order to underline a point that they're making. The only Audre Norton book that I've ever enjoyed, Time Traders, struck me as good particularly because she brought to life the culture of the people among whom her time travellers was going. This is something that is often overlooked in time travel stories. Similarly, Frank Herbert, at last year's Oakland Convention, gave a fascinating talk on how he evolved the Dune World series. And here he was drawing on the real-life experience of cultures like the Badawi. And because this is something about which we do not normally learn very much in Orthodox history lessons, it has a nice exotic alien flavour. And because it is drawn from a real background, it has a quality of solidity and internal consistency, which gives it a weight that I think enormously enhances both the novels Dune World and Prophet of Dune. As a matter of fact, I also borrowed myself rather freely from George Stewart's information about mythical countries in America when I was writing the third of the Don Miguel Navarro Society of Time stories, which came out in Times Without Number from Ace. I think one would be justified in stating that the majority of both readers and writers find a kick akin to the one they get from science fiction in historical periods marked by confusion productive of paradox, thoroughly jumbled up and resembling our own century in the sense that ordinary people's environment could be changed at random. A conqueror could come over the hill and turn your life topsy-turvy. Similarly today, somebody working quietly in a lab somewhere could completely alter our own and our children's lives. And well handled, the same sense of wonder can be generated out of the Vikings by Franz Bengtsson in The Long Ships, or out of India in John Masters' books, or out of much less promising material. So the lure of the exotic, I think that's a prime and obvious element in science fiction's appeal, is by no means unique. I'm going to cite Carpentier again. I've often recommended his book, The Lost Steps. It's a kind of time travel story in the 20th century. A New York musicologist voyaging up the Amazon and measuring his progress backwards in time by the yardstick which is most meaningful to him, the music of the people that he goes among, till finally he winds up among people who are so primitive they haven't yet invented music. It's a tour de force and well worth reading if you haven't read it, and a lot of people think that it is very similar to much of Jimmy Ballard's work. Now let's turn to the pair of attributes that I'm terming constrictive. I could equally call them inward turning, introvert. I could, in fact, almost have called them cosy. Because usually there are two ways in which one's preferred entertainment reading can make one feel more connected to the universe. First is the one which we've been dealing with, which is the enlargement of you to contain the externals. And the second is the shrinkage of the externals to fit you. And it's very nice and reassuring to have this huge and sometimes terrifying cosmos shrunk to fit and tightly fenced in with a crash-proof barrier. Well, actually, that's much too sweeping an exaggeration. In taking the first of this pair of constrictive attributes, what I really want to examine is an aspect of the reverse of what I've been talking about up till now, and that's the applicability of rule and system to the universe. Many definitions of science fiction fall down on things like time travel, which is obviously not scientifically feasible at present, and yet isn't pure fantasy either. It follows to me that the central thread running through science fiction and uniting it is an acceptance of the existence of scientific method, which gives us a handle to get hold of such slippery things as time travel. So the corollary of my first expansive attribute of science fiction, the sense of vast forces and vast changes, is the generation of the wholly self-consistent construct, bounded neatly by a set of perfectly definable propositions. I subsume under this heading most of the ambitious and rather highly intellectualized stories which are produced by our outstanding writers coming from an orthodox scientific background. Whether I'm doing them an injustice or not, I wouldn't try and guess. But I do have the impression that people like Isaac Asimov and Hal Clement hanker after a tidier framework for their characters' lives than real life can offer. And this one would assume to derive to some extent from their scientific background. But it's not by any means confined to people with a strong scientific bent. One of the clearest biggest ways in which this tendency is revealed, it seems to me, is the habit that many of us have of building stories around a systematized, centralized assumption. The reductio ad absurdum technique of the space merchants, for instance, and heaven knows how many other stories as well. It seems to me this is a reflection of the same tendency, and so too is the love-hate relationship between science fiction and Catholic dogma. At least two of the Hugo winners, Case of Conscience and Canticle for Ludovic, that you've seen this very plainly, and if I can be forgiven for referring a second time to one of my own books, I used this consciously and deliberately in Times Without Number. Paradoxically, it also appears in science fiction writers' concern with magic. You might think in my ad hoc classification that that fell under the heading of the lure of the exotic, but I don't think it does. I think this fondness for theology and equally for magic is because these two are par excellence the result of the unfettered exercise of human intellection, untrammeled by unpleasant, contrary experimental facts. And I think that this obsessive fascination with a set of boundaries and a set of rules, a collection of rigid laws, is possibly science fiction's most nearly unique attribute, but I'm afraid it's not really our private property any more than the preceding two instances. One of the most obvious examples is Asimov's robotic stories, for instance, which consists basically of changes running on the loopholes in his three laws of robotics. It seems to me that these are akin in spirit to the classic locked room detective story, which are resolved by an insight which is, says the author, either deducible from the information given or assumed to be the common property of reader and writer. And I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of writers are Sherlock Holmes fans, a lot of writers in the science fiction field. Also, one or two outstanding writers of science fiction have written very, very good detective novels with strong science fiction overtones. People like Fred Brown is the most conspicuous example that I can call to mind. But the parallel of the detective story goes so far in this area of science fiction that I can only skim lightly over it. I think it covers a great many alien and parallel world stories in which the question is not who done it, but how did it? In the same sense as the classic detective story, these are mysteries resolvable in intellectual terms on the basis of the author's postulates. There are a lot of parallel world stories, for example, in which the denouement is an arbitrary function of the difference between the real world and what the author has said goes on in the parallel world. But of course, the overlap occurs elsewhere too. This self-consistent universe can be lots of different kinds. It could be of the Lewis Carroll type, where you're indulging in straight-faced consideration of non-real cause and effect, or you're anthropomorphizing the rules of a game. Another not coincidence is the recurrent tendency of science fiction writers to write chess game stories. Poe Anderson's one who's succumbed to this, and so have I, and Ballantyne will publish it in December, and the rest of the city, and Commander Brecken. I'd carry this argument a great deal further, and I'd say that this is so little the unique property of science fiction that it can be done by authors who actively dislike science fiction. Consider Colin McInnes's Absolute Beginners. It's allegedly a novel about teenagers in London of the early 60s, who bears absolutely no resemblance whatever to real life. But the mood of containment within a set of rules and boundaries is so flawlessly sustained that it doesn't matter. It becomes a piece of pure intellection, like the Tolkien trilogy, or perhaps Well of the Unicorn, or all other kinds of story like that. And it seems to me that you could carry this argument over into the field of the spy story. Half the successful spy stories of recent years, not those on the John le Carré axis, but those on the Dayton-Fleming axis, are exactly like this. They are a self-contained world operating within a set of definable postulates. I could push this all the way into start referring to things like Burke's Law, and I've had my disbelief suspended more efficiently by Burke's Law, I think, than practically anything else I've seen for a long time. But there's one thing about this question of setting out definable rules and postulates, though. One cannot possibly, within the confines of a story of publishable length, set out all the rules applicable to a given situation. But unfortunately, this tendency does carry over into the way authors handle their characters as well as the environment. And this connects to a sort of subsidiary appendage of a point I was making just now. Just as Edmund Crispin has pointed out that science fiction is the last refuge of the morality tale, in one sense, it's also the last refuge of the heroic type, not of heroes in the, you know, in the James Bond sense that always come out laughing and good for another book, but of a particular sort of heroic type which is perhaps special to science fiction. Being a kind of descendant of the morality tale, John Wyndham could take time off in the middle of Consider Her Ways for several pages of social analysis and speculation, Bob Heinlein puts over social and political theses and so on, and this is regarded as being more or less acceptable in the same way that a chunk of preaching was accepted in medieval romances about King Arthur and his knights, that sort of thing. But you will have noticed that there are rather few science fiction stories which honestly try to deal with the information made available by human nature from anthropology and psychology. We're getting some social psychology, some sociology, but this is generally, I think, keyed to satire, social criticism, rather than to the mainstream of science fiction. In other words, it seems to me that the least tractable element of science fiction, the one least capable of being constrained within a set of definable postulates, is the element that science fiction is least happy with. And the sciences, anthropology and psychology chiefly, which analyze this intractability of human beings, their orneriness, their cussedness, are taking longest of all to filter into the accepted vocabulary of images and associations with which we work. And I think this ties back very closely to writers and readers' approval of disciplined organization. I promised to come back to the C.S. Forrester's novels and novels of that kind, which are very popular among people who also read a great deal of science fiction. It seems to me this is a perfect example. Aboard a sailing ship in a vast ocean, you have both the sort of bounded world, the ship itself, and you have the definable set of rules, essentially naval discipline and seamanship, which together form a capsule example of this constrictive aspect applicable to science fiction. And there's another reason why we like the dogma of theology. The rules of a monastic order, as in Canticle for Leibowitz, or Father Luis Sanchez's Jesuit vows in Case of Conscience, are nice and handy for imposing limits on the human contrariness of the characters. I could go into this at much greater length, but I am going to cut myself off here and come back to this point I was making about the heroic element in science fiction. It seems to me that this ties up with my underlying thesis, again, of being enlightened by one's chosen reading. Heinlein is extraordinarily good at creating archetypal science fiction heroes, whose heroic attribute is not that they are big-thewed and sword-swinging. No. They know exactly what they are doing. And this is the attribute of a science fiction hero. It makes one think, at least it makes me think occasionally, in moments when I caught off guard, wouldn't it be nice if we could handle the universe like this? How much better if the world were conquered and domesticated, and everybody in it was straightforward and manipulable instead of complicated and troublesome? In essence, though, there's an apparent paradox that in good SF you may limit the depth of your characters, and yet somehow in limiting the depth of your characters you get good science fiction out of it. I think it's resolved when one comes to consider the last of the four attributes which I've taken out for study, the second of the constrictive or inward-looking ones. And briefly this, I think that one hell of a lot of science fiction, more than anybody I have ever met is willing to admit, is downright wishful thinking. And in that sense, it's on approximately the same footing as the Lenny Library romance, which the heroine always gets the handsome, adoring husband, or the Western where the tall, misunderstood hero always guns down the vicious rustler, or the tough thriller where the private eye always collects three blondes on the way to the showdown with the boss of the syndicate. There is naturally no reason why wishful thinking should not be incorporated into something which is outstandingly successful. The first example that came to my mind was one of yours, Arthur, the trick that you pulled in Childhood's End, where after setting up the overlords in the opening section, which was originally Guardian Angel, you then pulled this rather nice switch and showed them as forever doomed to envy mankind, because they are at the end of their evolutionary path, and we are not. Think also of the way, time after time in science fiction, all the evils of the world have been laid at the door of malignant alien meddlers, like the Vitons and Sinister Barrier. And once they've been seen to, everything in the garden will be lovely and we'll go on out and conquer the stars. Everybody will live 1,000 years except the villains, who will get their commands. But regrettably, wishful thinking, though it may be fun, has one very, very serious drawback. It gives only the illusion of any kind of enlightenment from one's reading, instead of the reality of it. When wishful thinking serves to remind one of an ultimate ideal, and to make it seem attainable and therefore worth striving for, then it has considerable value, considerable importance. But when it's taken like a trial, when it's taken as undiluted escapism, it is... it reduces, instead of improving, our connection with the world around. It turns us inward, it closes us, encapsulates us, and shuts us off. I've noticed that there are among people who read science fiction a lot who seem to find the world too much for them, and one would rather suspect that there are a few writers like this too, who tend to work through pleasant and often inversely nostalgic stories with an excessively simple morality and naive message and a milk and water set of characters to boot. I don't propose to spend any further time on this particular aspect of science fiction, because although it's sufficiently common to be noted, I think it is not notable. Now, look at these four attributes of science fiction. Two, sort of expansive or outward-looking, sense of vast changes, sense of the exotic, and two, constrictive or inward-looking, the bounded world bit and the wishful thinking bit. These are not science fiction's only attributes by a long way, but they seem to be both conspicuous and characteristic. I can't offhand think of any science fiction story that doesn't contain at least one, and generally all these in varying proportions. Rather reluctantly, I've concluded that not one of these attributes is unique, and indeed most of the time you can turn out from outside science fiction examples where the writer made a better job of what he was setting out to tackle. But hang on a moment, one is not to deduce from this that science fiction is worthless and a waste of time. What one is going to deduce, I think, is that it's a pretty fruitless job trying to analyze a subjective reaction all the way down to this kind of basic element. There still remains the inarguable fact that every now and again science fiction can conjure up a moment of pure magic. And for most people who read it, it's worth reading through ream after ream of second-rate hackery. Because when one does hit, that moment of magic has a special indefinable aura one can't get from anything else. The closest analogy I can find to this is one which was in fact used to make a delightful little short story in fantasy and science fiction some years ago. I forget who wrote it, but it was called $1.98. And Arthur Porges, thank you very much. This was about a very small, underprivileged genie whose tricks were limited to $1.98 worth of goods. And it is alleged that this was, at the time, the market value of the constituent portions of a human being, the carbon, the water, the phosphorus, the calcium, and all the rest of it. So the hero got the girl who'd been rejecting him into his bed, and this was worth all kinds of money to him. And similarly, it is not really much good taking the isolated elements of science fiction, because they aren't science fiction any more than the individual notes are a musical score. It's the totality you have to look at. But you have to know what's going on. What does seem reasonable, by way of explanation for the rather, perhaps, in a sense, depressing conclusions that I've worked my way to during this talk, is that, effectively, there is not any longer, if indeed there ever was, such a thing as science fiction. We shall go on talking as though there were, because it's a matter of convenience. Look, I can probably make this a lot clearer if I stand my earlier points on their head. Let's work backwards from general science, from general fiction to science fiction for a change, and we'll consider the resemblances between the kind of kick one gets from other kinds of fiction and the kick one gets from SF. For my money, at the moment, there is nobody working in our field who can hold a candle to Philip K. Dick. It's not just that his ambitious stuff, like Man in the High Castle, is tremendous, it's that his things like Clans of the Alpha Moon and the Simulacra and Dr. Blood Money, which seem, by contrast, almost casual, are still terrific. He is so good, he scares me. The kick that I get out of a Phil Dick novel is akin to Vance Bourget's work, for example, Confessions of a Spent Youth or The Hound of Earth. It's much closer to that than anything else in the science fiction field. There's the almost Swiftian element in Kurt Vonnegut's work. You might just possibly, stretching a point, compare that to Evelyn Waugh in books like The Loved One, which has this same tremendous awareness of the ridiculous and heightened true absurdity by his paradoxical confrontation of the comic and the conceited. And similarly, I think there's a new and very encouraging trend which one can observe. Formerly, you know, if a non-science fiction writer tackled a science fiction theme, all the regular reviewers would say, wow, and a science fiction reader would say, bleh. Well, it's due to an enhanced awareness of what science fiction can do when it's turned on and let run. I don't know whether the awareness is among publishers or among writers. I don't know. But lately it has been notable that when a non-SF writer comes along to tackle a science fiction thing, he does seem to take the trouble to study it out before he sits down. I think Anthony Burgess, for example, made a complete tour de force out of Clockwork Orange. It was dazzlingly brilliant. Naomi Mitchison drew sort of analogically on her knowledge of African tribal customs, and she made Memoirs of a Space Woman into not a great work, but certainly one I think that regular readers of science fiction could read with interest and approval. Whereas a few years ago, the stock example of something like Mordecai Rochefort's Level 7, which I thought was so ham-fistedly bad I couldn't finish it. And yet, all kinds of respectable names were raving about it in the regular papers. Now, I find this the reverse of dismay, because it seems to me to imply that breakthrough... we hope a breakthrough, which has been horribly long in coming, may finally be arriving. You may not any longer have to excuse science fiction's shortcomings, but you can apply the standards of general fiction. When the best SF available was being written by Van Vogt, or worse yet, by Ray Cummings, one usually had to say, well, you know, disregard the fact that the characters are cardboard, but think of all that violent action, that colour. Well, you know, really, it wasn't up to the standard set by Wells 30-odd years previous. It's a terribly sad reflection on our literature of the future that it's so heavily conditioned by the old pulps. I think, with luck, I'm selling a straight novel to John Caldas in an experimental style. I think that there is not a science fiction editor in the business to whom, if I had sent a comparable novel in a comparable style, you know, he'd have sent it back on grounds that the readers would not have understood it. When Bester pulled his typographical trickery into Honest Man, or when Wolf did all those fireworks in Limbo 90, it came as something of a shock. But Philip Wiley was doing it in Finley Wren back in 1934. It was old hat when he got at it. Even now, you know, the number of people who brought the full range of the modern fiction writer's armoury to bear on science fiction, the list of them is depressingly short, and it includes an awful lot of outsiders like George Stewart and Edgar Pangborn. But there is a kernel of science fiction-type science fiction writers in there on that list, people like Sturgeon and Dick and Lish. And the list, I think, is tending to grow. I look forward to the day when somebody can get up in front of an audience, like I'm doing this afternoon, and talk about the way in which the kicks obtainable in general fiction can be matched by kicks obtainable from science fiction. Then we will have got some. By Ethel to say, would I call for questions? Yes, I'll happily call for questions.
Oh, come now.
Look, I know I said a lot, but I didn't say it all. Children are in fact watered down versions of things that were far more horrific and far more adult. Consider, for example, Grimm's fairy tales. If you get hold of a translation of the original version which the brothers Grimm collected, you will find that these enshrine not entertainment for children, but folk traditions, some of them going back to beliefs in pagan gods. And in this sense, I think science fiction does draw a great deal from the fairy tale, not in its modern watered-down version, but in the classic sense. Well, the Germans call Märchen, and I think the best English term for this is household tales. Just as tales of wonderful travel were drawn on to form part of the science fiction canon, so too, I think, the myths and legends which survive in bastardized form as fairy tales have a very strong and definite influence.
You'll have to shout a bit, I'm afraid.
Don't Frank Russell's Vitons have a certain relationship to Jean Jacques Rousseau's, there is the idea that that man is essentially good but has been perverted into evil by some outside force.
I think it's not only in Sinister Barrier that one gets a reflection of this belief. One of the curious things about science fiction is the way in which, even through periods when such ideas are not dreadfully popular, we somehow manage to cling to a number of liberal humanist ideals. And one of the most tenaciously held beliefs, I think, of any liberal humanism is that man is essentially of his nature perfectible. The comparison with Rousseau and Russell is one which I hadn't noticed before. It's particularly apposite because I presume that Russell is an anglicized version of the name Rousseau. But, yes, you'll find this cropping up, I think, as a subdivision of the category which I referred to when I talked about a preference for characters in science fiction who obey some kind of nice pattern, like the rules of a monastic order. It would be very nice indeed. The world would be a much more comfortable, much more peaceful place if everybody operated exactly according to a liberal humanist's preconceptions. Speaking as a liberal humanist, I am somewhat saddened to admit it, but it is true. People do not.
In some of these stories, you get a perfectly balanced story in its whole, and it's unfortunate that it's a great glaring error. Do you think it's used deliberately, or it's used in ignorance?
Well, could you give me an example of the kind of error you have in mind?
I can't remember the tale of it, but there was a spaceship in space that had a damage. It was supposed to explode in about 20 seconds. So to get the passengers across from one spaceship to another, he just pushed them in the airlock, said that the exposure to space would do them no harm.
I'm very glad to deal with the point, because this has been criticized. In two stories, I've used the idea that man can survive exposure to vacuum, and I've been severely criticized. I'm very happy to say this, that it has now been experimentally demonstrated. You can take climates down to complete vacuum and just carry on working quite happily until they pass out in about 15 seconds. And if they're recompressed after about 2 minutes, they're okay. Thank you very much.
Science fiction seems to be the last refuge of the morality tale, and that as such we should put up with, or we should expect to find in it, large chunks of plain preaching, and you instanced authors and works. How would you comment on the fact that this seems to have been the case in a great deal of popular writing, well, even from the very beginning? I'm thinking particularly of people like Dickens and Thackeray, who introduced great chunks of solid preaching into their works, and Fielding as well, and
Well, essentially, I think, quoting Evelyn Crispin on the question of science fiction and the morality tale, if it wasn't him who said it, I apologize, but it seems to me to make a kind of sense. Without going into great detail on the economics of 19th century authorship, I would suggest that one of the reasons why didacticism was so common in the novel of the 19th century was that the reader wanted meat and substance at all costs. It was the heyday of the three-dagger novel, and if you took something out of your local subscription library, you wanted to keep it for a good long time. You wanted a good, meaty, muscular read. This kind of didacticism has gone more or less completely out of fashion in contemporary mainstream fiction. I don't know whether it can be entirely ascribed to improvements in the sheer craft of fiction writing, though I'm inclined to think that there are elements of this involved. A moralizing contemporary novel will typically, not now, contain chunks of preaching. It will exemplify and demonstrate, and you will be left free to draw your own conclusions. I'm skating rather superficially over this, but it's a very deep and complex subject. On the other hand, in science fiction, it seems somewhat less amiss than it does in a regular contemporary straight novel. I cited John Wyndham's Consider Her Ways because this is a particularly spectacular example. Halfway through the story, the heroine is simply sat down and lectured at for page after page on the history of the world up to this moment when she's arrived at. I've never actually noticed anybody complaining about this in a review or in conversation or discussing Wyndham's work. It does tend to provoke a lot of adverse comment when it happens to be something like the didacticism of Starship Troopers, which is highly unpalatable to most readers of science fiction, at least so it seemed to have turned out. At any rate, I cannot recall any other writer than Heinlein who has provoked quite so many counterblasts in fictional form. Myself, I rather like the technique which has been involved in contemporary fiction, and even if somebody is going to write a science fiction story with a nice tidy moral on the end, I'd much rather have it acted out convincingly by characters who believe in what the author believes, rather than standing up and talking to one another about it. The element of didacticism and moralizing in the 19th century novel, though, I think you will find is at least partly attributable to economic determinism. When you get people like, one example that comes very strikingly to mind is George Reynolds, founded Reynolds News. We have lying around at home a copy of his Miscellany for 1848, and he was turning out a whole ruddy weekly paper by himself. And, he was an archetypal hack. He wrote one or two pretty good gothic novels. But because he had to make so many installments out of them and spread them over so many issues of his periodical, every now and again you stop off for half a page of preaching about the miserable plight in which the heroine has got herself into, and if she had never listened to the wicked Sir Jasper, she wouldn't have not now having her, be having her toenails gnawed by the rats, you know. Well, for the modern reader, I think it sort of follows that she should have called in the rodent exterminators.
First, I'd like to thank you for what appears to me to be one of the best critiques I've heard yet of the whole science fiction question. And I say that I was sorry that you skirted away from the question of the theological aspects. You cut yourself off, as you said. Do you think in the in this gradual breakdown of the notion of fiction, science fiction, do you think that there's room for a profounder theology? I'm using the word very broadly there.
I think one of the things that science fiction is contributing to mainstream fiction is an enhanced awareness of the long-term problems of humanity. And in this sense, I believe that there very probably is the hope that you're looking for. What I mean by that is we are, I hope, going to see a fusion of John Wyndham's masculinist versus feminist attributes, poles of fiction. One of the best books which illustrates this that I've read for quite a long time is Vance Bourgeois's Confessions of a Spent Youth. I just read it when I got caught up in a correspondence argument about how science fiction depicts a changing world. And I was forced to admit that I had never read anything in science fiction which conveys such a sense of change as this novel. And Vance Bourgeois isn't even top in his own league. Thank you. Whether we are going to see spiritual, religious themes appearing more and more in fiction, I can't say. I think that's chiefly a function of the social climate. But certainly a greater awareness of long-term trends and problems, and a greater awareness of the fact that we are, after all, in a mess of our own making, if you like. We can give a sense of direction to the confusion and chaos which surrounds us. I think this is the way it's going to work out.
Well, This is beginning, and there's a hint here that you believe George Orwell, but the politics is one basis for one of the main reasons for writing. But the expressing one's political views using politics in the broadest sense is one of the reasons for writing, along with egotism and the desire to have, to make a living in a relatively easy way.
Well, as to politics, yes, in the sense that just about everything is politics in an organized society, the way your children are educated, the state of the streets you walk on, the cleanliness of the water that comes out of your taps, everything in the ultimate analysis is political in a society that is organized the way ours is. I wouldn't say, though, with Orwell, that politics is one of the main purposes of writing, and I certainly wouldn't confess to the belief that I've just been accused of. What I would say, though, is this, that one of the definitions of man is the political animal. Writers are men, therefore some writers tend to be somewhat political. And while not wishing to see a science fiction novel which is a political tract, I do feel that political speculation is one of the great unworked areas of the science fiction novel. Its surface has barely been scratched, and I can think of only a handful, please don't ask me to think of one right now, but I'm sure I can think of a handful sometime, of science fiction novels which really have some valid political speculation in. I'd like to see much more done in this area, because after all, it's somewhat absurdly dogmatic to stand pat on present-day social organization when every other aspect of the world around us is changing almost faster than we can see. It's often adduced as a drawback of science fiction from Eastern Europe that the writers are working within the confines of the eschatological content of Marxism. In other words, it's as though they were working within a kind of universally accepted future history. But on the other hand, somebody who writes about a private company mining the asteroids in the 25th century is also making a political assumption. The organization of economic systems is the prime bone of political contention in this 20th century. I would very much like to see more freewheeling speculation about politics in the sense of social organization in science fiction.
Novels in which the politics and the fiction are almost completely separated into different chapters.
I'm very glad that we've got Mac Reynolds. The thing that I'm most glad about Mac Reynolds for is that he set up this beautiful system of people's capitalism, with everybody having this inalienable shareholding in it, which I'm quite sure some of my conservative economist friends would cheerfully defend. I started from there and went on to show exactly why it wouldn't work. This I found enormously entertaining. I'm not entirely certain that he does segregate his politics and his action into separate chapters, though. It seems to me that he does rather successfully integrate his political assumptions into the action. I think that he ties back most of his plots very thoroughly indeed to his underlying political assumptions. I'm very glad that we've got him, and I wish we had a lot more people working not the same vein of this, but working, exploring other similar avenues.
In dealing with theology and psychology in science fiction, how would you relate to Heinlein's Stranger and Strangeland?
This is a big one. Because Stranger and Strangeland is such a grab bag. It contains some of the very best elements of Heinlein's work. One of the things that Heinlein does superlatively well is to create characters, you know, in quotes. He's a character, in that sense, and I think Jubal Harshaw is one of his most magnificent creations in that regard. But this apart, this sort of unifying bond that runs through it in this excellent central character, I was somewhat disappointed. While I was reading it, I thought, So what? It's a roller coaster ride. But it doesn't go anywhere. It brings you back where you started. You've seen a lot of country on the way. But even the, if you like, the eschatological content of it is not integrated. The specific references to the afterlife, for example, seem to me to be very badly integrated as between Valentine Michael Smith's Martian and his human constituents. It's left completely open and unexplored one of the most fascinating questions, to my mind, which would have been, to how great an extent did Valentine Michael Smith's conditioning as a Martian in his human body extend to the conditioning of his psychic remnant afterwards? This I would have liked to have seen going to, and there are several other things which struck me as being let off like fireworks. As to its actual theological content, no, I won't really venture an opinion, because theology is not a strong field of mine, and the only reason I spoke about it so much was because two recent Hugo winners happen to have had this element in common. I'm sorry if that's a very disappointing answer, but I'd rather not dig deeply into that. I'm being signalled by Ethel. Shall I take one more, Ethel? One more and then finish. Well, Phil, I saw you make out first.
John, do you agree that in the presence of little vision of the world, it would be very difficult for science fiction writers who sincerely believe that possibly some good come out of the Soviet communist setup to write and sell, say, the American market, a story based on this contention, in the same way that people have sold stories based on extrapolation of present American capitalism sort of 2 or 3 centuries into the future, like the asteroid story you mentioned.
I don't think that this is entirely true, in fact. It partly depends on the reactions that the editor has been getting from the readers lately. It also depends, by and large, on how good a story is. Take that story of Mac Reynolds, for example, where the Americans were shocked to discover that the visitors from the stars landed in Russia as being the center of the most developed, most advanced society on Earth today, or rather in 1970-something. This was bought, it was sold, it provoked a lot of discussion. It was an interesting idea. I rather wish I had thought of it, quite frankly. I'd like to have had a go at that kind of thing. But there is, I rather suspect, a close parallel in Western attitudes to communism and Eastern attitudes to capitalism and heresy in the period of religious intolerance. I've noticed often, our American visitors will forgive me, but this is the honest and absolute truth. I've noticed very often in talking to Americans about communism and communists, a sort of wall goes up with a label on it. The label reads, Communist, verboten. They haven't dug around into what communists believe. They would no more think of filling their minds with Marxism than a devout Catholic would have thought of reading up on the Black Mass. And this sort of area of ignorance is the real barrier. This blanking out, it operates exactly in a parallel sense on the other side of the world where, you have to feel and feel and feel in conversation for a very long time before you establish any point at which you are communicating on the subject of the organization of Western society. Perhaps the most baffling experience I've ever had in my life was at the Moscow Peace Congress in 1962, trying to get across to members of the Soviet Peace Council exactly what a Western pacifist was trying to do. It took an awfully long time before we began to understand what we were talking about. And I think it's this area of non-comprehension rather than any rooted prejudice. Of course, the non-comprehension stems from prejudice, but prejudice can be eroded, whereas ignorance can be, as the Catholics say, invincible. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed for being so
was a good audience.